You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya on September 11, 2012 that killed four Americans triggered a debate over military covert operations, a number of classified CIA programs, and the nature of domestic politics. Because the attack occurred just months before the presidential election, it became a topic of political squabbling and partisan finger-pointing, which continues to overshadow the story of what actually happened, who was responsible, and how it could have been prevented. Now, Jack Murphy and Brandon Webb of the Special Forces website SOFREP.com have written Benghazi, the definitive report based on 4 months of investigations into the attack. It's an e-book original published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased to welcome Jack Murphy and Brandon Webb to our show. Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Do your backgrounds in the military give you access that other journalists might not get?
Absolutely. I think that's one advantage that we have.
What did you do?
On SOFREP, this is Brandon, and I'm a former Navy SEAL. You establish deep friendships and trust over years, and it's an advantage I think we have over traditional journalists is that we've got a pretty extensive network, and you know, we do a lot of good things on SOFREP.com, and it's mainly run and by former veterans of special operations.
And what did you do, Jack?
I served in 3rd Ranger Battalion and then 5th Special Forces Group, so I was 8 years in the Army.
Who did you speak to, and what records and other information did you have access to in order to put together this report?
Well, it was a combination of both primary and secondary sources. Some of it is open source. It's white papers and reports that were put out by the U.S. government. But Brandon and I both also consulted with people across various government agencies, people who were on the ground, people who knew what was going on there. And I think it really gave us some insight to put out a book like this.
Did any of the things that WikiLeaks had released help you?
Yeah, absolutely. I referenced the cables that Ambassador Stevens had written. And I think those cables really give a great insight into Stevens and his character and what a sharp guy he was. That was actually instrumental in fleshing out the background of Benghazi and Libya and what was going on in that country.
What did you think of journalists when you were on the other side, Brandon, being reported on rather than doing the reporting?
Well, you know, I respect journalism and what we have in this country under the First Amendment. I think it's a great thing and what I fought for overseas. So I support it. You know, the person.
But you are critical of the media throughout this.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people in the mainstream media want to do they care and want to do good things, and but it becomes a situation where you have these big companies that control the media, and you have spin on the left and spin on the right, and our only bias in Benghazi is towards the truth and getting the information out there.
So let's get to the story. At first, it was said that the Benghazi attack was the culmination of protests in Libya over an amateur film that defamed the Prophet Muhammad. That theory was corrected, but can you talk about where the idea came from?
Well, I think the idea came out of the State Department originally. They were the first ones to start putting that out.
Hadn't there been protests in other cities
in Egypt
over that film? So yes. It made some kind of logical sense.
Yeah, it did. And I think at the time, the State Department really didn't have their eyes open, didn't have visibility on a number of operations inside Libya. So blaming it on a YouTube video, yeah, it could have been the natural course of action, even though they jumped the gun and probably didn't show their due diligence in blaming the attack on that.
Well, it's been suggested that they did that as a kind of a cover-up for something else.
I don't think it was an intentional cover-up, but I think it was something that they went with initially and then felt they had to stick with. It was a long time before they corrected it. And that narrative, that story that the attack was inspired by a YouTube video is actually much better and sounds much better for the administration than the reality that we lay out in this book.
So, Brandon, can you describe the city of Benghazi and the state of it since the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011?
Well, I'll actually defer to Jack on that. I mean, he did a really good job of diving in and writing a historical background and bringing us up to where we are.
I think the two places you really have to focus on in Libya for this story is Derna and Benghazi. And both of these towns are hotbeds of Islamic extremism. Derna is a traditional home of not just terrorism, Islamic terrorism, but also a history of opposition to outside influences, be it the Ottoman Empire, the Italian colonizers, and then later on Gaddafi. And
both of these cities had been important in the attempt to overthrow Gaddafi.
Absolutely, very much so. And there's a very real contribution that those two cities made into overthrowing Gaddafi, although the role of the Salafist militias may be a little bit overblown in their role in the revolution. I think they might be trying to take a little bit more credit now that the war is over, but they did play a role.
Now, what was Chris Stevens, the United States ambassador to Libya, doing there? Wasn't he stationed in Tripoli?
Well, I think that the important thing to point out here is a large part of the political power base is located in Benghazi with these militias, and that's why Stevens was up there promoting diplomacy and trying to, you know, establish these relationships. And it's just the nature of the threat that existed in Benghazi. We point out the timeline and all these different attacks that occurred over the summer, and the British pulled out their one of their convoys, the ambassador's convoy, got hit with an RPG attack. The writing was on the wall. But, you know, people ask, why was Stevens in Benghazi? Well, that's where the power players were at.
And he seems to be rather brave. He had entered Libya during the Civil War.
Yeah, he was very brave. I mean, what he was doing was almost something you'd more associate with a special forces soldier during the war. He went in there during the conflict to establish rapport with the revolution, with these armed groups that were fighting Gaddafi. And I mean, I'm not trying to insinuate he was doing anything other than diplomacy, but I mean, it was very brave of him what he did.
Did he speak Arabic?
Yes. Yes, he understood the culture very well.
So he entered Libya as a diplomat knowing that there was going to be a transition, because by the time he got there, it was quite clear that
right.
Gaddafi was going to fall.
Right, and this is kind of sort of an aggressive form of diplomacy, that you're going to try to engage with these rebels while the war is ongoing, before there's even a conflict resolution.
Had he been aware of growing Islamic extremism in the area in the year before the attack?
Very much so. Stevens was very sharp. He knew exactly what was going on in regards to the cultural issues inside Libya.
And North Africa has become, you know, we've put so much pressure on the Islamic extremists in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you've seen this influx of radicals, Islamic extremism in North
Africa.
Foreign
fighters as well.
Yeah, a lot of foreign fighters.
And isn't that a concern right now in Syria, where some people are hot to just get involved, and others are saying a lot of foreign fighters have
yeah.
gone there, and do we really want to support the people who will do something similar to what we've seen in Libya and in Egypt
as
well?
The FSA, the Free Syrian Army, is a very nebulous group. It includes everyone from hardcore al-Qaeda fighters to people who probably aren't that different than the founders of the American Revolution. So there's a disparity between all these different types of factions within the FSA, and you have to be very careful on how you go about approaching them.
So in Benghazi, there were an awful lot of foreign fighters?
Yes, there are quite a few foreign fighters who traveled also from Derna to Benghazi for the attack. And if I'm not mistaken, this is one of the reasons why you haven't seen as big a retaliation from the United States government as you might have thought, because a lot of these foreign fighters dispersed outwards after the attack.
My guests are Jack Murphy and Brandon Webb, who've written an e-book. It's a rather slim e-book because you want to get it out quickly, but also there's about 50 or so pages of real material here.
I think it's about like 80 pages. But yeah, it's a short e-book, a short report that people can pick up and read on the subway to try to piece it together.
Powerful narrative, I think. It's been well received. I mean, there's no fat in there. It's just, you know, it's a good piece of work.
And it's called Benghazi, the Definitive Report. After 9/11, Gaddafi began cooperating with the United States in the war on terrorism. How did that affect Islamic extremism and anti-Americanism in Libya?
Well, that's a very interesting question to pose, and I don't think we have all the answers to this day. But there was an internal Islamic extremism opposition group, the Libyan armed group, that Gaddafi was struggling with. And so this made Gaddafi an unlikely ally of the United States in the years after 9/11. And we cooperated with him on a number of counterterrorism initiatives.
And we'd also were pleased that he had dropped his nuclear program.
Absolutely.
And he seemed to be cooperating with investigations into some of the very terrorist acts that he had been connected to.
So I think if you look at the political dynamics internationally, when did things really shift from were Gaddafi's friend to now we're taking him off our Facebook friends page, and he's no longer on part of the crew.
And that's an important issue, I think, is what we do in the world. I mean, I think, you know, there's many that would say, oh, we've got enough issues at home, let's, you know, focus inward. But the nature of this, the threat these days, and that it is this asymmetric issue of radical extremism throughout the world, it has to be addressed somehow. But we need a clear strategy on foreign policy. And you talk about Syria, Egypt, Mali, everything that's happening in the world. And in this case in point, what kind of example are we setting for future leaders of these countries when they look at, well, you guys, you know, Gaddafi and was supporting your agenda, and all of a sudden you turned a switch and flipped it, and now what? So it's about trust and having a clear strategy when you're dealing with what's happening in the world. And I don't think we have a very good strategy right now. We're kind of running around in this whack-a-mole terrorist, you know, and in supporting regime overthrow, and then what are the long-term consequences?
Well, not just the United States. Most of our allies are, in fact, a number of them are more committed than we are.
Yeah.
Mali, which seems to be kind of like, directly connected to what
initiative.
We're talking about here, but mm-hmm. The French have been very involved.
Yeah, there's a number of players involved in all of these countries. And to which extent are third countries being used as cutouts for various intelligence services is another interesting question.
Now, you looked at what Ambassador Stevens was thinking. Did he have a pretty good assessment of the growing problems in Libya?
Yeah, I think Stevens had a very good assessment on what was going on, and he understood the need to upgrade that what we keep calling the consulate in Benghazi was actually a temporary mission facility. And Stevens believed that should be made an actual consulate. It should be designated a consulate, and there should be a diplomatic mission there. So Stevens, he knew the importance of Benghazi, and he understood the dynamics of what was going on in that area. Unfortunately, what the State Department and even the CIA personnel in the area couldn't have seen were some of the military operations that were taking place aside from what they had going on.
Why couldn't they have seen them?
Because they're so compartmentalized. They're deliberately obscured, deliberately kept secret.
It's a well known that a lot of these groups, you know, and the JSOC, which is the Joint Special Operations Command, contains a lot of the Tier 1 Special Operations personnel. The CIA and State Department often don't talk to each other, and it creates problems, as in this case. If you don't know what each other are doing, you're going to bump up against each other.
What was Stevens's relationship like with John Brennan, the president's nominee for the director of the CIA? He was the president's counterterrorism advisor at the time.
My understanding is that they definitely had some disagreements, if not being somewhat antagonistic towards each other, because Stevens was pursuing a diplomatic mission inside Libya. He was a career foreign service guy, while Brennan is taking sort of a ham-handed approach to counterterrorism operations across the Middle East and North Africa. So these two ideologies clashed with each other at some point.
We'll take a little break, and then we'll come back with Jack Murphy and Brandon Webb, authors of Benghazi, the Definitive Report, which is based on 4 months of investigations into the attack on Benghazi. It's an e-book original published by William Morrow. And we are back with Brandon Webb and Jack Murphy of the Special Forces website, SOFREP.com. SOFREP standing for?
Special Operations Report.
And they have written Benghazi, the Definitive Report, which is available as an e-book original from William Morrow. You write of a secret war being waged across North Africa involving State Department diplomats, CIA, and Joint Special Operations Command covert operators and military Islamist groups. Can you tell us about this war? When did it begin, and what did it involve, and is it still going on?
Well, I think it's really been ongoing for a long time now, and as I try to write in the book a little bit, give a little bit of historical context, that our history with Libya is really a history of conflict in many ways, going all the way back to the very founding of America and the Barbary Pirate Wars. But if we're to speed forward and to look at the war on terror,
from the halls of Montezuma to the walls
that's
of
right.
Tripoli.
Yeah. If we were to look forward post 9/11, I think this war has always been going on to some extent. what you have is, as we're going to push fighters, and we're going to push these Islamic extremists out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're going to maneuver them around with our efforts in Yemen, they're going to go somewhere else. They're going to go to places like Somalia. They're going to go to places like now Libya, places like Mali, where there's a power vacuum, where there's a weak state. So this war has been going on for a while, and I think there's been a real escalation just in the last couple of years, and with the fall of Gaddafi, frankly. I mean, he did have a stabilizing effect on the country, although he was a dictator.
Now, should we be using the word al-Qaeda here, or are these other groups?
I think it's easy to drop everything in the al-Qaeda bucket, but I think we're really dealing with is a culture of radical extremists.
And the group that we are talking about in this context is Ansar al-Sharia. How powerful a presence is it in Libya?
It's debatable. I would say they're not that powerful. They're not all powerful. But they do have a presence in and around Benghazi. They claim that they had a part in fighting during the Libyan civil war against Gaddafi's forces, which others who I know who fought in the civil war actually say, now they were kind of marginal if they were even there at all. But they do have an effect. They are one of the militias. They do have some guns and some training camps, and they're a presence.
And it's run by a man named Abu Sufyan bin Kumu.
Kumu.
Wasn't he in Guantanamo
at one point? He sure was.
Yeah. Strange how things work.
Yeah, he was in Guantanamo.
He's one of the guys that got freed.
Yep.
Because they didn't think he was dangerous?
Yeah, he was let out and given back to the Libyans, where Gaddafi promptly imprisoned him. And then he got out of Libyan prison when Gaddafi had, you know, an alms, you know, charity day at one of the prisons. And he was released as part of that initiative.
So was he radicalized before Guantanamo?
He was running a charity front organization in Pakistan and Afghanistan that was funneling funds for al-Qaeda. But it seems that he may have gotten a little bit more radicalized through his treatment in Guantanamo. At least that's what he says publicly, in his words.
Well, his organization says it's involved in civic improvement. Is that a front, or is this the way some of these groups work? They help the poor at the same time that they're engaged in this other kind of activity.
It could very well be accurate. It could be true. There's a number of these groups who are trying to establish legitimacy for themselves in these local communities, especially when you have poor areas and the government doesn't provide very many services for the people, that a group like, you know, say Hezbollah is very well placed to go in and help people after bombings and things like that. And I mean, whether you like these groups or not, I mean, there is a sort of agenda behind what they're doing.
Hamas as well. Was Ansar al-Sharia behind the attack on the consulate? Did they organize it?
They were one of the many they were one of the main fronts. They were probably augmented by AQIM, the al-Qaeda presence there in northern Africa, with also foreign fighters. So they were under the banner of Ansar al-Sharia, but joined by others.
And a man named Abu Qatala, affiliated with Ansar al-Sharia. What was his role in this? No, you don't know? Okay. Maybe I got the name wrong. You write that Joint Special Operations Command counterterrorism operations began in the summer of 2012. Are those covert classified operations?
Yes, very compartmentalized and actually run in somewhat of a non-traditional way, as they're being authorized directly by the National Security Council. And those operations were launching into Libya. They were targeting a high-value target, a al-Qaeda, one of the last big al-Qaeda personalities known as al-Shuri. He's a facilitator of funds and foreign fighters. Also, they were going in there to reclaim weapons that the militias had taken over during the war.
Big problem was the loose weapons, the yellow cake, which is the uranium. So, I mean, there's a big the same concern we now see in Syria. You know, where are these loose chemical weapons going to end up?
And in the case of some of these loose weapons, they wound up in Mali, didn't they?
Absolutely.
In the wake of Benghazi and the investigation into what happened, have our operations come to light? And have they become compromised?
Some of our operations have come to light. They're still very much classified, and not too many people are talking about them at all. But I think Benghazi kind of puts the spotlight on a number of different programs, one of them being these covert operations, direct action missions into Libya, but also this weapons transaction program from Libya to Syria.
How much would Ambassador Stevens have known about these Joint Special Operations Command?
Well, I think that was the problem. He had very little visibility.
Very little, if any. I think he was smart enough that he may have been able to make an inference and understand that they were happening, but he wasn't being read onto them.
But you suggest in this book that the attack on the consulate is related to these covert operations.
Absolutely. That it was blowback. There was a series of operations over the summer. And if you look at in the State Department's own reports, there's an escalation in terrorist attacks on our assets in Benghazi over the summer.
Well, we say that the compound was a consulate, but you point out that it wasn't really.
Yeah, that's correct. It was actually a temporary mission facility. And I should probably correct myself. I just keep saying consulate because that's what it's become known in the media. But it didn't have the funding or the prestige that an actual American consulate would have.
Much has been made in the media and at the congressional hearings of the request for more security at this compound that weren't responded to. Were there threats against it before the attack? Did people there really feel like they were in danger?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I spoke with one of our sources who was actually on the UK ambassador security detail when they were ambushed. And the State Department actually helped out on the aftermath of that. So they were very aware that the timeline, which is open source and published in the State Department's internal report, points out that this escalating violence towards the Western presence in Benghazi. So the writing was on the wall, and the request for security went up. They just went unanswered, and I think that's...
Do we have any reason why?
Well, a part of it was also because the diplomatic security personnel were rotating through that temporary mission facility so quickly that there was very little continuity from one to the other. I mean, you can imagine if, you know, we had to establish security on this radio studio, but there's a new person in charge of security every day. It would just
be a learning, constant relearning.
Right.
And I think a lot of why Benghazi is important is there's a lot of lessons in Benghazi that we can learn from, you know, and figure out, okay, how did this happen? You know, how do we approach, you know, our foreign policy strategy in the future and really deal with a lot of these radical mullahs throughout the region that are recruiting these, they have the money and they're recruiting these young men and giving them purpose in their life. And that's a root cause. Like, how do we affect change and stop the bin Ladens of tomorrow from developing? And that has to be part of our strategy, or else we're just going to go and when does it end? We're going to kill terrorists indefinitely.
My guests are Brandon Webb and Jack Murphy of the Special Forces website, SOFREP.com. They've written Benghazi, the Definitive Report. It is an ebook original published by William Morrow. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, there had been other incidents in Benghazi in the months before the attack, but do we know if this was a long-planned, well-coordinated attack or something that was just thrown together when somebody said, oh, gee, September 11th is coming up. We should do something.
I think it was somewhere in between. I think September 11th was clearly chosen for its symbolism. I think the riots, the protests in Egypt, and maybe even the YouTube video helped some of these people mobilize some of the younger extremists in Benghazi and Derna. But it was actually an operation, I believe, in September, just days before the consulate attack, that really set this thing off and really kicked the hornet's nest. But a U.S. military operation.
But isn't intelligence supposed to pick up on this sort of thing in advance?
But that's the problem when you have JSOC operating on a separate sheet of music than the CIA. You have things happening and cause and effect, and these groups don't talk to each other, you end up, you know, in a pretty bad situation, especially in such a confined geographic location.
And then there were security guards working at the compound, Blue Mountain security guards. What kind of group is that?
It was basically a Libyan militia that had been contracted to guard the facility.
They fled when the whole thing began.
Cut and run. They didn't even have guns.
They had bats. So you can imagine when you have an attacking force that's armed and you have a
machine guns,
a
and
club.
RPGs.
Yeah.
and why was that? Was that based on some agreements?
I think it comes
protocol?
Down to funding, security funding. You have foreign indigenous personnel guarding the perimeter of the CIA annex who are very well armed, but they were funded, and the annex security posture was
because of the rising extremist faction inside Benghazi. Even those Blue Mountain security guys didn't want to be seen as protecting Americans.
Yeah. Does the fact that this wasn't a true consulate, that it was more of a temporary facility, explain why it wasn't given more adequate protection?
Yeah, it explains why it wasn't given the funding and the attention that it needed. And it's unfortunate that Chris Stevens wasn't able, or his words weren't heeded, to actually designate it as a consulate much sooner.
So can you describe what the attack was like, what happened?
Sure.
Who was there at the time?
I mean, you had Stevens and Smith, who had just conducted a meeting within hours of the attack. They'd finished one of their last meetings. They had chose to hold their scheduled meetings inside their compound it was September 11th, and they were concerned about security. In hindsight, probably would have been better to hold those meetings off-site because it would have been well known that was a State Department compound to everyone in the area. But, the initial attack happened. I think it was initiated with an RPG, which was a rocket-propelled grenade. And the security, the perimeter security, those guys ran right away.
And weren't the gates left open?
Yeah, I mean, literally left everything open and booked out of there. And the problem was, in the Tactical Operations Center, the on-duty DSS security agent saw what was happening on the video cameras, and literally they had barely enough time to literally lock themselves in place.
But then there was a fire.
Yeah, so
I'm not sure you want to lock yourself in place is on fire.
Yeah, and it's how do we get word to the ambassador in his villa? And they did send one guy to the villa to get word to Ambassador Stevens and Sean Smith. The problem was when they entered that villa, the attacking force had grabbed some of the extra fuel that was there to power the generators, and they started recognizing that the one agent and they knew that people were holed up in this villa. They tried to smoke them out, and eventually, the Stevens and Smith both succumbed to smoke inhalation. That's how they died. The one agent did make it out and try and go back and rescue him.
Well, the response team was led by Ty Woods.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, so the dynamics here was as this is happening, the guy in the Tactical Operations Center, the State Department guy, put out a call, most likely on a cell phone, to the CIA annex and said, look, we are under attack and we need help. Like, we've been overrun. And the initial response from the chief of base for the CIA annex was, okay, well, we can't do anything right now. We're not going to go in there. To Ty's credit, Ty Woods, who was a former SEAL, he said, look, we, as an experienced special operations guy with 20 years in the SEAL teams, he said, we can't wait. We can't sit here and wait. It's going to be too late. We're going to lose Americans, more American lives. And so he really was assertive and stood up to the chief of base and made a case, said, look, here's why we need to go. And eventually those guys, it was himself and five other GRS agents in two vehicles, went over to that compound, which was, within a few miles away.
But they had to face how many attackers?
The numbers are estimated, around 100. So, it goes to show how, by the nature of special operations, you have a very small unit that's able to initiate the element of surprise and really, these guys are highly trained and that can create what they did was they created a space and time for them to go in there and disrupt the attack and get those State Department guys out.
And they did it in like 15 minutes.
Yes.
It's amazing how fast they went in. They were able to clear that huge compound and rescue the people.
Drones were also employed, weren't they, but surveillance drones?
Yeah, I think later on that they had, in North Africa, AFRICOM has access to drones, and they did redirect a Predator overhead to get situational awareness to what was going on. Which did ultimately end up, in my opinion, saving all the Americans in Benghazi because they used the drone footage once they pulled back to the CIA annex to realize that, hey, this is not going away. The problem's getting bigger and we need to leave now.
Now, blame was laid at the feet of Hillary Clinton and the State Department by many, but you paint a more complex picture. The State Department is only one of a number of actors in Libya. The CIA, the Joint Special Operations Command, also involved. And you say that one of the big problems is communication among the different agencies. So can we avoid this sort of thing in the future by having better communication? We've been talking about having better communication ever since 9/11.
Yeah, it's not just communication, but it's also the nature of secrecy and military secrecy and intelligence service secrecy. And to what level do we read people in to other operations? And I mean, if you have too much operational security around a program, it can actually lead to failure. And that was something that came out of even Desert One in 1980, that the thing, different parts were so compartmentalized that nobody really knew what was going on.
Well, we needed Ben Affleck to lead the whole thing.
I mean, it comes down on the larger stage. It's these political turf wars and these career bureaucrats that, you know, at what point do you put your own personal agenda aside to do what's best for the country?
Well, do you think the discussions and finger-pointing over Benghazi was purely politically motivated because it was something the Republicans hoped would help them win the election, a way to find fault with President Obama and the Secretary of State?
Yeah, but because it happened in the run-up to a presidential election, it was very, very much politicized. And you know, I'm sorry to say, but I don't think it would have gotten nearly the coverage that it should have if it wasn't during an election.
On the other hand, I have a feeling that it doesn't matter who was in the White House. This is the sort of thing you're saying because of lack of communication
It's the same game from administration to administration. Yep. It didn't really matter who was the president at the time.
As we saw in the lead up to 9/11 and all of the miscommunication there. Well, thank you so much for coming by to talk about your book, Benghazi, The Definitive Report. Available as an ebook original published by William Morrow. How do people get it? Go to Amazon?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, pretty much wherever major booksellers are found on the internet.
Yeah.
And its authors are Jack Murphy and Brandon Webb of the Special Forces website, SOFREP.com. Thanks.
Yep, thank you, Len.
Thanks for having me.